I found it very challenging to start on like we say in Icelandic, on a school bench again, you know, basically to start an education at my age. But it was so refreshing to tackle something new and kind of conquer yourself. You know, you really need to be disciplined. You need to learn a lot of things. You need to sort of read a lot of things.
Welcome to the Attraction Pros Podcast, where we discuss the latest trends and challenges facing the attractions industry today.
We chat with some of the top leaders in the field and provide resources that will help develop your career in this great industry.
I am Josh Liebman. I am obsessed with the guest experience and helping attractions make that their top priority for success.
And I'm Matt Heller. I am passionate about organizational effectiveness, leadership development, and employee engagement.
Now sit upright, hold on tight, and get ready for the Attraction Pros Podcast. Hey, Matt, how's it going?
It's going fantastically, Josh. How are you?
I'm doing well. Question for you.
Yes.
Have you ever been to Iceland?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. It just so happens that we were there just a couple of months ago. Why do you ask?
I've just been, I don't know, thinking about it a lot lately. I don't know, some podcast I'm listening to, this guy's talking about it a lot. No, I think it all culminated to this. I got to hear about your trip on the Lessons from Iceland episode. We even talked about it in one of the mini-sodes we did about taking pictures of guests. We now get to talk to your tour guide, Bjorn Knudsen, who I'm sure I'm not pronouncing that correctly, because there is a very big difference in the way we pronounce things in English compared to the way words and names in Icelandic are pronounced. But this was such a fascinating conversation. But did you know how Iceland got its tourism boom in the last 14, 15 years or so?
Well, I did, but that's because I was on the tour. And it had a lot to do with a volcano erupting, which allowed people to learn more about the area and really, I think, be curious about it. Like, I've got to go see that. Like, it's like when anything happens around the world, right? And it gets all this press, people are drawn to it and they want to go see it. Yeah. And that's one of the big reasons that Iceland has gotten a lot of tourism in the last 15 years.
It's kind of like all press is good press, right? Is really the message in this, because Iceland was just on the news for, what was it, 10 days straight or so? I remember, I was living in Orlando. I think we were both living in Orlando at the time. I was working in guest services at Universal, and we were getting many guests, from the UK and from throughout Europe, who were supposed to fly home, and they were basically stranded in Orlando, and we had to find, you know, accommodations, both hotel, and I think we offered some sort of, I don't know if it was discounted or complimentary theme park admission to people who couldn't get home, because of this volcano that's erupting in Iceland. So that to me, I think, was actually one of the biggest facts that I learned about Iceland just from this interview. But we learned so much from Bjorn about being a tour guide, about the attractions and tourism business in Iceland, and so much about what went into your actual experience while you were there with your wife and with your friends.
Well, and I think what's so cool is you asked me a question, so you turned the tables on us a little bit. But again, what I think is so cool is the fact that what he talks about from giving a tour in Iceland is something that anybody in any attraction, any hospitality business can apply to what they're doing, because he just talks about, you know, treating people the way that you want to be treated and making things special for people. And, you know, from my perspective, you know, he created an incredibly memorable experience that we cannot stop talking about. I mean, what attraction operator wouldn't want that for a review? You know, if people leave your family entertainment center, your museum, your theme park, and they're continuing to talk about it with their friends, and if they have a platform like a podcast and they keep talking about it on the podcast, or they're broadcasting it on social media, I mean, what better advertising can you have than that kind of word of mouth? So that's why I felt it was really a cool opportunity for us to have him on the podcast.
Yeah. And the key point there too is after the tour, you were talking a lot about Iceland, but you were also talking about your tour guide who made the experience. So yeah, Iceland is there and it's fantastic and beautiful, but it was Bjorn who really brought it to life and who really brought out the, you know, how magnificent it is. And that anchored a significant part of your memory. He also talked about his career path, and he used the phrase conquering yourself. You have to conquer yourself. He started out as a sailor working in freight transportation, ended up in aviation transportation by overseeing operations at the Iceland airport, and then into the wine business where he opened a wine school. And then as a tour guide, every single one of those, he brought with him all the experience that he carried with them, up until then, but he had to conquer himself to get to that next step in his career. And the way that he shares that, I'm very inspired by it.
Awesome. Well, and the other thing he talks about kind of along that path is really managing logistics, because when you think about any kind of transportation, it's logistics, right? And then when you think about the tour business, which is another form of transportation, because we're on a bus, there's a lot of logistics there. And I think his ability, like when you bring this full circle, his ability to manage the logistics of our tour, there were a lot of things he did behind the scenes that we never knew about. Some of them he told us, like, we can't go to this place, so we're going to this place instead. Like, that was just, okay, we're going to follow Bjorn because he's driving the van. But he made those arrangements because he was looking ahead. And again, that's a great business lesson for anybody, no matter what type of tourism business you have, attraction, any kind of business, to be looking ahead at the logistics and taking care of those things so that your guests don't even know it. It just becomes a seamless experience.
Magic.
Magic. So should we get on the bus and head to Iceland with this interview with Bjorn?
Let's do it. Don't forget your crampons.
Hey, Bjorn, welcome to the Attraction Pros podcast. How are you doing today?
Fantastic.
Wonderful, wonderful. Thank you so much for spending the time with us today. So excited for this conversation. For people who have heard a couple of our past episodes, you've heard me talk about my trip to Iceland. Bjorn was our tour guide over in Iceland, and this is going to give me a chance to kind of relive some of that fun. But before we get into that, Bjorn, can you talk to us a little bit about your career history and kind of what has brought you to where you are today?
Yes, I'd be glad to do so. Well, you see, in Iceland, it's a small country, you know, so you have to choose your career path, I think, early in life if you want to succeed. So what I did was that I was keen on being a sailor. So I went early on because, I mean, at that time, the fishing industry was number one industry in Iceland. So I went both on fishing boats and on merchant ships, and did that for a few years, and which was very interesting. And then I went to the College of Navigation, and graduated with a mate's ticket, as they call it. And at that time, I wanted to go and be a mate on a merchant ship. But this was at the time when containerization was getting in. So there was a lot of decline in the merchant fleet. So that meant that I was kind of without a job before I actually finished my education to that extent. So what I did then, I went to the United Kingdom, to London, and I studied to be a shipbroker. And from there, I went to university to take a postgraduate degree in port and shipping administration. And by that time, I had already been hired to the company I'd been working for as a sailor. And then I went straight into the office to start to work for them. So I did that for a number of years. I was in various roles. For example, I was a regional manager for the USA and Canada. And then I went to take on an island that is between Iceland and Europe. It's called the Faroe Islands. So we were starting up a joint sailing system there, and I was put in there. And then at that time, I got headhunted, and my career took me then to Australia and New Zealand. So I was working there as an operational director for a French shipping company that was doing island trade into Papua New Guinea, Fiji, Vanuatu, New Caledonia, and Tonga, and Samoas, etc. So I went down there and was there for 3 years. And then, as happens, my family didn't want to kind of become Australians or New Zealanders. So, and I had a teenage daughter at the time, you know, and so it was difficult. So we decided to pack and go home. And I applied for a job with no aviational history, but I applied for a job as the director of the international airport in Iceland. And out of, I think it were 26 applicants or something, I succeeded. So I was asked, and I think it was because of my international experience more than anything else. And of course, also with some, because it's all transportation when it comes down to that anyway, and logistics. So, and there I was for 10 years. And at the time I was also offered by my government to go as a diplomat to the International Civil Aviation Organization in Montreal, Canada. And I went there, and it's quite kind of common when you are in the service of your government that they ask you to go and represent the government or the country at some international, you know, bodies like the one that I mentioned. So I did that also. And when I came back, this was at the time when the U.S. military, after a decision by Donald Rumsfeld to basically close down the base in Iceland. So that was a huge task to take over all the operation from them, integrate that into Iceland and so on. And then I was there for like another 2 years, and then I got offered a very good position with another company, left the aviation industry and went into logistics for a company that was a big importer of de-icing salt in Iceland, and also fishery salt and packing material for the fishing industry. And there I was for close to 3 years. And then I moved into sort of a consultancy business on my own. Was again headhunted to start up an airline with a good friend of mine that I met in Montreal, Canada. He was he was like the story, you know, he was a billionaire and started an airline to become a millionaire because, you know, you lose so much money in that anyway. So I was there with him and founded that airline with him called Wow Air, and it was there till the year 2015. And then I moved into consultancy again. I had, in that meantime, was diagnosed with a sort of a malignant cancer in my adrenal gland, so I had to kind of a step down, so which I did. But I went into my consultancy after I recovered and did that for a number of years. And then at the age of, when I turned 60, I had already decided that I wanted a career change, and I wanted to do something totally different. And that's where the wine school project comes into play, actually, because I got the wine bug when I lived in Australia. I there was a wine shop very close to where I lived in Sydney, and every Thursday they had a night called Meet the Winemakers. And what was so good about that? Well, you got to see the winemaker, you got to speak to them and so on, and you got a free drink. So that was a perfect way to spend the Thursday night. And then, you know, we carried on with that idea with the wine school over here. And for a year, I just was basically studying. I studied for various international exams, basically to frame in my experience or sort of, you know, what I had already learned, but kind of frame it in and get a certificate on the wall. Who would start a wine school without credentials? And then I got approached in the year 2022, actually, by a lady who was running a company called Arctic Adventure. And I met her during an event, and she said, why don't you, because I was giving a presentation about wine and so on, and she said, you'll be a perfect tour guide, have you considered that? And I said, well, no, I haven't considered it, but I know my country quite well, and I'd be willing to look into it. And then I decided then to go on and take that further examination in terms of how to drive a bus, you know, because I didn't have that license at hand. So I did that January 23 and straight went to work for Arctic Adventure as a tour guide in 50% position. And then the wine school also as an addition to that. So that's where we are today.
Yeah.
That is so fascinating. Thank you so much for sharing that career story. I enjoyed following along there from the sailor to working in the transportation business on water and then aviation. So still transportation, but in a completely different capacity. Real fascinated how you said you applied for the position at the airport without aviation experience, but that they saw the transportation experience so easily that the transferable skill sets kind of going through that. And curious as far as kind of how you've carried that mindset, you know, throughout, you know, the rest of your career and then, you know, doing the consulting for many years, deciding to open the wine school required gaining a new set of skills and certification. And then same thing with being a tour guide as well of kind of continuing in a way, starting over, but also bringing everything that you've brought with you beforehand to that. So curious as far as if you're able to share a little bit, maybe about what that mindset is like of with these steps that you've taken of in some ways it's starting over, but in other ways it's using everything you've had up until that point.
Yeah, thank you for that, Josh. You see, I found it very challenging to start on like we say in Icelandic, on a school bench again, you know, basically to start an education at my age. But it was so refreshing to tackle something new and kind of conquer yourself. You know, you really need to be disciplined. You need to learn a lot of things. You need to sort of read a lot of things. I made all kind of cards with little what do you call these little cards that we have sometime, you know, these little cards that you write things on, you know, and to rememberize, you know.
Little note cards.
Yeah, little note cards. There is another word for it, but it come to mind later on. Okay. And
index cards, flashcards.
Yeah, flashcards, flashcards. That's the one. Sorry for that. But yeah, and I wrote a lot of them on myself. You know, I started by doing an education, which is called the WSAT, which is Wine Spirit Education Trust. So I decided to go for level 3. So, you know, many people start by going to level 1 and 2, but I thought I was more advanced than that. So I'd go for level 3. And I succeeded into that and graduated with a merit, actually, which I went to London and did it through a wine school in London called West London Wine School with a fabulous guy called Jimmy White, absolutely fabulous guy. And then I took then the Spanish wine scholar, the French wine scholar, and I ended up with the Italian wine scholar. So I got these three, and I'm just waiting to be able to sign for a program on the which is called the Masters of Bordeaux, because I feel I'm lacking some information about that, you know, etc. So I want to do that. And you know, you just need to be, you need to conquer yourself, and you need to think, well, you know, you can do it. And I don't know if I'm that disciplined, but I think that I have that kind of mindset that requires you to go out of your comfort zone and basically tackle things. And I think that comes from the fact, for example, let's say you go to Australia, you relocate, you start in a totally new environment, and you basically have to go and tackle everything like I did. That prepares you for taking on things later in life.
You know, one of the things I really appreciate about what you just said, Bjorn, was talking about getting outside your comfort zone, because I think about when I was on the tour with you and there were things that, you know, we did, like especially walking on the glacier, you know, with our crampons and things like that, was way outside of a lot of our comfort zones. And you helped us get there, you know, with your encouragement and things of that nature. But I just feel like there's that mentality that you're talking about not only had an impact on your career path, but also has an impact on the experience that you create for people that are coming to your tours, whether it's your wine school or the Arctic Adventures tours. And that's one of the reasons that I really felt it would be interesting to talk to you, because at the end of the day, you're creating experiences. And that's what Josh and I talk about all the time in terms of whether it's a theme park, an amusement park, a family entertainment center, a cultural attraction. We're all creating these experiences. And I just felt like the way that you did that for us on the bus, we still talk about it. We still talk about, you know, Bjorn and how special you made us all feel and all the little surprises that you had for us along the way. So I guess my question is, taking all the things that you just talked about and really turning that into an experience for people. You've got 18 people on the bus, right? And now you're creating an experience for them, showing them your beautiful country. And how do you approach maybe that process of putting that whole tour together and being able to create such a wonderful experience for people?
Well, this is a very good question. I think that you have to be a little bit of a psychiatrist as well. You have to read the people who come on, and it gives you an experience. You know, your fellow countrymen are usually very open and thirsty for knowledge, and they're, you know, they are here to travel. They're here to have a fun, whereas some other groups of travelers are not so very interested listening to you, but they're more kind of a ticking off box. You know, it's their bucket list. I got to tick off the Golden Circle. I got to tick off the Glacier Lagoon. But then they sleep in between. And if that happens, you kind of forget, you know, they mute you to a certain extent. You know, if you look in the rearview mirror, you've seen everybody with the closed eyes. You know, what am I supposed to be telling them, you know, waking them, or do they want to take a nap or something like that? So you got to read the group. You got to see, okay, I've got those people here, you know, and then you start. And you start to explain also, which is basically something which I would call an excitement control or expectation control. You basically tell, well, you know, we're going to be here on a 6-day travel, so I'm not going to tell you everything at once. You know, as we get along, I'll explain to you the geothermal activities of Iceland, the volcanic activities of Iceland. We'll go through, if you want to know about the Icelandic government, or you want to know about the education system, or you want to know about this. So give people the chance who want to learn about these things. And sometimes I've even have to say to somebody, if you're not interested in what I have to say, maybe you should sit at the back of the bus and those who are closer to me, because it's also a distraction for me to listen to somebody in the back, you know, in the back of my head. I can hear somebody talking about something. I can't be encouraged to go on. You know, I'm not in competition with them. You know, this is a guided tour, and a guided tour means that you're here. You know what you have paid for. You have paid for a guided tour. That means the driver guide will be speaking to you along the way.
I've got to imagine that that presents a lot of challenges, and in a way, no two tours are the same for the guests, but also for you as well, because you have to really read that and really adapt to that. So can you tell us a little bit maybe about how you do that of recognizing, oh, here's the guests, they're chatting with themselves, or oh, they just want to sleep, and okay, I respect that. And here's someone, maybe they're not, you know, as tuned in, you know, as they could be, but maybe I can tease that out of them and find where their area of interest is. Are there any kind of secret ways of doing that?
Well, thank you, Josh. One of the way to do this is basically to ask people for, which I did frequently. I said, can I have your attention, please? I really want to tell you about something here. So when you approach it like that, you kind of mute those who are talking, because you have already, you know, you're not sort of talking all the time, but you are telling them there's something coming up. I really want to tell you about it. So you kind of ask for attention.
And one of the ways you ask for attention, I got to bring up the car quiz, because we had so much fun with that. Can you explain what the car quiz is?
Yeah, it came up once because there was somebody on the tour who was very keen on playing some music and asked me, you know, can you play some music or something like that? And I said, well, yes, I do have a Bluetooth and I could do that. And then that person sort of thought, wow, you know, do you think you can play this and that and so on? And I said, listen, I can do that, but do you have your own playlist or something like that? And he said, no, I don't actually, but, you know, I'd be interested if you could do this and that. Or could you play some Icelandic songs and so on? So the idea came about actually because we have some long drives, you know, and then people are, you know, when you look in the rearview mirror, you see that maybe 80% of the bus is awake, you know. Some do have something in their ears, you know, like some iPod, you know, these earplugs, you know, and so on. So you know they're listening to something. But then you say, okay, should we go into a competition? I'm the one controlling this here, and you, the bus, you're one vote, and I'm one vote. So do you know this song here? And I said, well, you have to know the name of the song and you have to know who is performing. So you put that out. And then, of course, you put maybe one or two Icelandic songs in there, but with famous Icelandic bands like Björk or Of Monsters and Men, Kaleo, Messaford, world-known bands, you know? And then this has kind of evolved. And on the trip that you and I were on, Matt, I actually put together like three lists extra because it was so much fun, you know. It was just, people were so delighted with it. So we kind of, I got so into it, you know. It was like a competition between, because we had that Australian guy who was an encyclopedia of music.
He was. He knew everything, and he was sitting right behind you. So yes, he could give you those answers very, very quickly. And it was so much fun. And you're right. We had a couple of long drives where, again, the scenery is beautiful, but there wasn't a lot that you were telling us in terms of stories and history and that type of thing. So it was a great way to, I think, not only bring the group together, but you know, the first goal, you know, we're passing time, but then it really did, I think, bring the group together and it got us closer to you as well.
Yeah. And when I played the Neil Diamond, the Sweet Caroline, and everybody were singing and you know and you had this extra you know, chorus as well, you know, and I kind of went, wow, this is amazing. So and of course we have some extra long drives, but nevertheless, I mean, as I always explain, that on this day, the highlight of this day is, for example, the whale watching, which unfortunately wasn't the highlight because we didn't see any whales, which was the first and only time that I've had that experience. I can say the group that came after you had success.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad to hear that. Yeah.
No, this is so interesting. I feel like I'm getting a glimpse into the tour. You mentioned Kaleo. I saw them in concert a couple of years ago, actually. They're fantastic. I have a question for Matt, actually. Switch things around a little bit here. So, Matt, you mentioned, you know, after the tour, you were talking about the tour, the experience with, you know, with your friends, and you were talking about, you know, Bjorn specifically. You know, we've gotten a glimpse of kind of, you know, what the tour was like, but I'm curious, what was it about the way that Bjorn delivered the tour and those elements of the experience that made it worth talking about afterwards, that strengthened the memory, that really kind of solidified it as being a positive experience?
I think for me, what it comes down to is that, you know, the tour was great. The scenery was great. He took it to some amazing places. But at the end of the day, Bjorn made us feel special, right? He made us feel like we were the only tour he's ever done. And it felt like all these little special things were just for us. And I know that, you know, we've talked about it afterwards, like, you know, Bjorn must have really loved us because, you know, he took us to all these special places. And, you know, that really made us, you know, not only have these wonderful memories, but again, kind of attach us to Bjorn as well. So I know, Josh, you talk about when you have a good experience and you have a five-star review, you're much more likely to name a person in that review. Well, for us, we spent 6 days with Bjorn, and it could have gone totally in a different direction, you know, if Bjorn was a different kind of tour guide. But at the end of the day, I think to answer your question, he made us feel very, very special.
So Bjorn, how do you make it feel like it's the only tour you've ever done? I think that's my follow-up question for you. What are the elements that go into it to create that very truly personalized experience?
Well, I think I can answer that, Josh, with saying, just be yourself. Actually, just, you know, if life has taught me anything, it is just to be genuine and be humble and be honest about it. I mean, you can't fool yourself through life. You just have to be sort of you have to be there has to be some core to it. So when I meet a new group, I'm not trying to say, well, this one is special or this one is something. I just do my utmost to deliver a good tour. And I think that, you know, what I have tried over the years is just to treat people the way I want to be treated myself. And that usually brings results by the end of the day.
Yeah. Well, and I think your knowledge of the country, you know, was something that was really, really impressive to all of us. And, you know, your level of hospitality, which is something Josh and I talk about as well quite a bit, in terms of how you treated us very much like equals and just as human beings. And I think there was, you know, at the beginning, obviously we were getting to know you, but then, you know, as the tour went on, it was like, you know, hey, Bjorn, get in the picture with us, you know, and those type of things. So that I think made it a lot of fun as well.
Well, I remember particularly when we had when we couldn't go and see Detifoss because of the road closure, etc. So we took a detour and we went up there, and you guys out to the snow and make snow angels and things like that. It was just, we did all kind of things, which as a group, you know, the group also was so engaging, you know, so that makes it so much easier for a tour guide to be at his best game is when he has the audience with him.
Oh, absolutely. We were with you. We're still with you. But I had a question because, you know, in our group, there were a lot of us that already knew each other. And then there were a couple of groups of people who were, you know, outside of our group, but we brought them in, you know, into the fold, so to speak. Do you find that most of your tours are people that already know each other, or are they a lot of smaller groups, like groups of two and three, where it takes more time for them to get to know each other?
Well, both, actually. I've had very often I have maybe a party of four, and then it's very often party of two, and then solos. And usually the Europeans, they integrate very well together, the Americans as well. And I find then, without saying this without any prejudice or anything like that, I find, for example, Australians really mix well in, because they are, to a certain extent, even though they are living at the other side of the world, you know, they are so westernized in their thought. But I really enjoy also people from Asia, because they are very often, especially those who are from, for example, Singapore and Hong Kong, and who have more international experience, and they are traveling, you see. You see, when you can categorize it, you very seldom would have a Chinese solo traveler. They travel in group. They go off very often in group to Iceland, and then they get usually a Chinese-speaking guide also with them, you know, which is also here. They would very seldom go on a trip like this unless they would have certain proficiency in English. And when they have that, they mix in right away.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things you touched on briefly earlier that I'd love to come back to, because it's one of the things we'd love to know about, is the elements of a tour that are out of your control. So for example, you go on a whale watching experience and there are no whales that that you see as part of the experience. Other ones just being about weather or road conditions. And as far as how you really plan for that to make sure that it's still an exceptional experience, even if it's not exactly perhaps what the group and or what the guests expected.
Well, just as an example, last weekend I was on a tour. I was on a 3-day tour, and I had a family of five from California, and they wanted to do the South Coast and the Golden Circle, and we had to reverse everything because all of a sudden there was just a massive depression coming over Iceland. There was so much snow in the east of Iceland, north of Iceland closed. The Snæfellsnes Peninsula, they had gone and done that the day before and had to go back without seeing more than half of it. So what I did, and I always do before I go on trip, I look at everything. I plan the trip before. I don't come into the office and say happy-go-lucky or something. I am, you know, brought up in the aviation industry and in logistics. You plan for things. You know, you look at things. That is a kind of a recipe for things, for you to be in control of things. So what I had to do that time was basically to move the glacier experience and order somewhere else, etc. Instead of calling the ops to ask them to do things, you take the matter into your own hand. And this is probably what separates the Icelandic guides from those foreign guides who are guiding in Iceland. And I'm saying they are many of them doing marvelous job, is that we are just, we have that connection net. You know, we basically know what to do, you know. So we kind of had planned for, we went on a Saturday, started the Golden Circle, and then I said to them, there's a good day today. Let's pack something in here because we don't know what tomorrow will hold. And then the day after, we were not supposed to do any glaciers, but I was up at 6 o'clock in the morning. I looked at the weather. I saw the road east from Kirkjubæja Cluster, one of the difficult names, one of the first hotel that we stayed at, Geirland Hotel. I saw we couldn't go. So I had arranged everything by 8 o'clock that we would go into a different glacial program to see that and so on. So that was fixed. And then the day after, we couldn't even go east then. So I took the people up to the tomato farm. We had a tomato soup and so on. And just basically everybody left happy. That is our job. But if I would say, well, leave it to the ops to do things, they have million things to kind of attend to. They have buses which are stopped somewhere and they need immediate attention and so on. So you kind of know that you just take matters into your own thing, those that you can. Then you just notify them, I've done this. And then nobody's going to say anything.
Yeah. Bjorn, I wonder if we could switch gears just a little bit and take a look at the Icelandic kind of attraction and tourism landscape, if you will. I remember one of the places we went to, I want to say it was a bit of a gorge and there was farms on both sides. And I remember you saying that one of the farmers was really into the attraction thing. He wanted to, you know, build a hotel and he was very into it. And there was another farmer who was really pushing back against that. He didn't want any tourism or attractions. So can you talk a little bit about just kind of where Iceland is in terms of its maturity and kind of where things are from an attraction or tourism standpoint?
That's a very good question. And thank you for bringing this up. The national parks in Iceland, they stand out. Why? Because they are funded and they're owned by Iceland, the nation itself, you know. So, and they can accommodate traffic because if there is a new trail to be laid down, etc., it's going to be done. But when you have these private attraction, then people need to either want to do it themselves or hand it over to somebody who can do it. We have what we call DMO, you know, destination management offices, which then can link to investors who say, okay, we do like a BOT. We'll take the project for 5 years. We'll do everything, restrooms, car parks, And then after 5 years, we transfer it over to you. This was the initial thought with that place that we were working on, because we saw, because I had been working in a capacity as a consultant on that project, trying to basically do a lot of mitigating work, actually, to try to get this person in who has a better view of that canyon than the other farmer, but the other farmer is receptive to do things. So in a nutshell, many places in Iceland are not ready for the amount of tourism that we're getting. But others are. So I think that as time will progress, we will get there. But for example, we do not charge people to see these places, which you don't enter Yellowstone without entrance fee. You don't go into some of these places without paying for entrance. The only entrance that they ask for is car parking things. And as I understand, a lot of these ones actually end up with the car rental companies and chasing the customers afterwards, etc., you know, because they didn't see the cameras or something like that. So it's still, to a certain extent, immature. We had to build a lot of hotels to accommodate the growth. And the growth really started after that big volcanic eruption in Eyjafjallajökull in the year 2010. You remember I told you about that?
Mm-hmm.
They were struggling in the newsroom of CNN to pronounce that name. So one said, I'm not going to call it this name. I'm just going to call it Kevin. So that's how they started to talk about that mountain as Kevin. Nevertheless, we started to get so much tourism after that. New airlines coming into Iceland, and the infrastructure of the airport was not there either. All the hotels, a lot of them were built out of prefabricated units who came basically in, you know, as a container hotels, etc. So many of them are still like work camps, you know, for a building site or something like that. But then at the same token, they are also building nicer hotels. But we kind of, because we have that mentality, the Icelanders, that we fix it, which called in Icelandic, þetta rettast, meaning we'll be okay, but we'll do our utmost. So that's pretty much where we stand today. We still need, but there has been, you know, we still need to map things up better. We don't do that. It's a very much an individualistic game, actually.
Mm.
So I remember the volcano eruption in 2010. I was working at Universal Orlando at the time, which of course is completely disconnected, but we had many guests who were staying with us who were from the UK and Europe, and we had to find accommodations for them because they couldn't fly home because of the impact from the volcano. My question, though, is how that sparked the tourism boom in Iceland.
Well, because we got so much news coverage all over. And we were the one. I mean, I've met people that said, well, I had to go and see what really grounded Europe for a week or 10 days, you know. I really need. So we got so much coverage, and it's all about coverage, you know. So we were just, on number one in many of the newsrooms day after day, you know, news about the ash cloud, you know, and thing, and how the volcano is progressing in Iceland and so on. So that's how we basically got on the map. We were on the map before, but this was just a huge exposure.
Yeah, you were on the map before for what? Fermented shark and things, right?
Well, there were tourism here before.
Yes.
And you see, when it comes down, why tourism has also developed in Iceland is because we have had these Icelandic airlines who have used Keflavik or Iceland as a hub, and then they feed cities in the US and they feed cities in Europe, and they link them through Keflavik. and they offer these ones. And if you want to fly to New York, why don't you stay over in Iceland for a couple of days? So that's why, for example, we have way more tourism in the southwest of Iceland. And that is what you experienced also, Matt. You saw that I wouldn't say that we were alone somewhere, but we were at least in areas where there were very few people.
I would say that was the more eastern and southern part.
Southeast, east, and part of the north.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, I remember there were times when we would, you know, drive for hours and hours, and I don't think we saw another car.
Exactly.
Yeah. It was kind of neat, actually. I describe it to people as feeling like we were on a different planet.
Yeah.
At times.
And then you're talking about managing expectation. You remember that night when we decided to go to Húsavík, because many people knew Húsavík from that movie, the Eurovision movie with Will Ferrell. Oh. And then we went there and we had a dinner there. And then we kind of slowly went back to Akureyri trying to go Northern Light hunting, you know. Which we were unsuccessful, unfortunately, but we managed to see the moon come up.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was interesting because we were looking for the Northern Lights, but we saw something else, you know, yeah. And I think that was one of the things that we loved about the tour is that, you know, there might be something that we were trying to get to, and whether we got there or not, there was something else that was still just as memorable.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I just have to ask, you know, before we started recording, you mentioned the hot dog. So I want to get the Icelanders take on the hot dog, because I did mention it in our previous kind of review of Iceland episode. So what makes that hot dog so special?
Well, I think what makes it special is these condiments that go on, you know, the raw onion, that fried onion. We of course have ketchup and mustard, but then you have which is called a remoulade. Remoulade is basically a mayonnaise with relish into it. So it's kind of a mayo sauce, and this is called a hot dog with everything. You know, we call it pulsa med öllu. Well, so it is something that I eat every now and again. And I just, you know, there are places that you want to go and have a hot dog because they make good ones. Mm-hmm. Especially the one down and downtown where you saw it, you know.
Yes.
That
yes.
Where you had to stay in line. Best hot dogs in Iceland. No question about it.
Yeah, they were very good.
So Bjorn, we're starting to wind down here. We just have a couple of minutes left. But before we wrap up, we would love to know, if someone is planning a trip to Iceland, what are the top three things that you recommend people see while they're visiting?
Well, I would definitely go and take the Golden Circle, because the Golden Circle kind of frames up a lot of things. It does the Parliament site, it does the Golden Waterfall, and it does the geyser area. Then I would say, and many people take a look at the south coast of Iceland, and then I would like to say the south coast to the Glacier Lagoon, you know, because I don't want to sort of you know, because when you go, for example, to the east of Iceland, that's slightly more isolated, but an area like the canyon that we saw, if you would have gone to the east part of it, it is absolutely breathtaking. So if mentioning three, Golden Circle, Glacier Lagoon, and Stuðlagil Canyon.
Very nice. And we will not be able to pronounce any of those, but we love hearing about them. So Bjorn, this has been just a fascinating conversation. I've learned more about you, even though we spent 6 days together. So if anybody wanted to learn more about your wine school or even get in touch with you, where would you send them?
Well, I mean, we have a website, which is in Icelandic. It's called Vinskólin. Vinskólin means wine school. You know, if you look at the wine school by the lake, then you will find us there. Now, just before we kind of, you know, close this, on the wine school for me is a passion. I don't want to be working on this full time, because it's the same with the guiding. It has to come from your heart, you know. It has to be a fun to do these things, because then you are at your best game. And I had, for example, one of the biggest wine importer in Iceland last night here in the wine school. And this morning I got a note from the CEO. I said, you know, this was absolutely far exceeded our expectations, because you made it so alive and fun. And that's what I want to do. And, both with the guiding and with it, not overdo it, but sort of, in moderation, should I say. It's the same thing I tell people when they come to the wine school. They say, are you teaching us how to drink? I said, well, to a certain extent, that could be, well, the fact. But I want you to remember that you always drink in moderation. Same with everything else, you know, moderation.
Excellent. Fantastic. Well, Bjorn, this has been such a fascinating conversation. We'll take the link to the wine school. We'll put that in the show notes so it's easy for everyone who's watching or listening to find. And for everyone out there who is watching and listening, just remember, we are all Attraction Pros.
Thanks for listening to the Attraction Pros podcast.
Make sure to subscribe so you can tune in when new episodes release. And even better, please leave us a review on iTunes.
For more information, visit attractionpros.com.